north of that is an area that's basically made out of what is so far lacking a nickname, tar limestone. This stuff is petrified. It's not on any reserve map. But what you can do is come up with insane plans, and this is one of the ones they've got. They'll use those nuclear power plants to create giant electrical coils to go deep into the earth, create temperatures of over 1,000 degrees, and boil all of that rock and try to turn that into something that will then start to be a tar sand bitumen at that point. So then you can conceive from there of building a tar sand process. This is on top of all of the plans for the natural gas from all of the various places in the north, including northeastern BC, to be funneled, as you say, in such a bad way. Composting caviar is what a friend referred to it before as. So when we deal with this nuclear expansion in Alberta, we have to be very careful. We don't allow them to talk about it as an alternative to building or burning the natural gas. It's in addition to burning natural gas, and it's to get more of this horrible climate-changing productive tar sand bitumen in the first place. When the crux of it, to me, is the peak oil climate change debate. There actually are two groups of people who are trying to deny peak oil. I would say one of them is the industry. Another of them are people like World Wildlife Fund and so forth. And a lot of that has to do with being wedded to the capitalist system and at the same time trying to fight climate change. If you say capitalism and its massive privilege needs to exist, and you also say you want to fight climate change, you have to deny peak oil, because peak oil is the argument that the industry will use for why they have to go through these absolutely insane measures to get what's left. By a bit of an analogy, during World War II, the Nazis would actually lose energy producing coal into oil, because it was the only way they could get oil, as you say, to run their fighter jets and so forth. That's the argument we're going to be given now, and it's by our current fascists, and we have to decide what we're going to do about that. But there is one other little point. Some of the associations for the study of peak oil people, ASPO, will state to you straight up, the IPCC's projections for the worst possible outcomes of climate change cannot be met because there isn't enough carbon left in the world you could actually gather up to burn it. So do we really want this bizarre race between will peak oil destroy civilization or climate change? Like, basically, peak oil is real. Climate change will be even more real if we don't stop it. Cut them both off right now.
That is writer, activist, and hitchhiker McDonald Stainsby. He is coordinator of a website called oilsandstruth.org. The tar sands mega projects in northern Alberta, Canada, are so horrible, so insane, I don't really want to talk about it. In fact, most Canadians and Americans prefer not to think about this issue at all. It is the world's largest strip mining operation. It is Canada's largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions. The tar sands are melting down gluey rock to feed America's energy addiction. As Stainsby will tell us, in this speech recorded in Vancouver, January 20th, 2008, in the Middle East, it takes about one barrel of oil to produce 100 barrels of oil, 100-to-1 gain in energy, but in the tar sands, it takes one barrel to produce just 3. Meanwhile, all the natural gas of Canada's high Arctic, and probably the American Alaskan supplies as well, which was once destined to heat homes or power stations, is now earmarked for the tar sands to melt down the rock. When that high-quality gas is used up, the big oil companies propose to build new nuclear power plants instead. The northern rivers are being drained off. It takes at least 4 liters of water to make 1 liter of oil. Giant, toxic tailing ponds are building up and leaching back into the river systems. Aboriginal people are being poisoned. The strip mines can be seen from space. I won't go on. The tar sands, for all these reasons, and especially for the climate change that they bring, have been called a crime against humanity. McDonald Stainsby tells us all we need to know in a series of reality checks for a society desperate for oil at any price. Stainsby describes himself as a rad green, part of a radical anti-capitalist green movement. In fact, he is a wide-ranging social activist fighting against war, for unions, and against oppression of indigenous people. He believes we are facing both peak oil and severe climate change at the same time. McDonald Stainsby's articles are published in alternative journals like Counterpunch, Zednet, Briar Patch, and Dominion Magazine. Let's listen to McDonald Stainsby, recorded by Radio EcoShock at the downtown Simon Fraser University campus in Vancouver, Canada.
Yeah, thanks, Mike, and thanks to the Vancouver Socialist Forum for organizing this event. Very important. One of the main things, the first thing I'll say is that people tend to look at the tar sands of Alberta, which will be my primary focus for this discussion, as an Alberta issue, when really it's not even beyond a national issue. It's an international issue which goes an implication far beyond just the continent alone. But I'll just give you a little bit of my own personal history as to how this became something for me to work on. A few years ago, perhaps naively, I thought I would take the summer off of doing politics for a while. And I went up north to the Yukon, Northwest Territories, and elsewhere, and tripped across a lot of areas that had previous unknown to me, particular land claims and things that had been set out for various hunting and trapping. Decided to do some research into that upon my return to where I was living, which was Montreal at that time, and discovered the history of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Project. The Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Project was started in the 70s, but at the time it was just a scheme to get natural gas and deliver it to southern markets, as they call it. But today, as they're bringing it back up for about the third time, following what the industry calls the pipeline structures downstream, I went downstream and found that they were planning to build this pipeline across 40% of that territory, which would be the unceded territory of the Detcho, right into the areas of northern Alberta to feed somewhere between 1.2 and 1.7 billion cubic feet of natural gas a day into the Fort McMurray expansion of the tar sands. So trying to figure out what that's all about. What is it that's driving this? Because that had become a major concern for me. Once you start scratching the surface of how the tar sands operate, it becomes immediately clear why people say things like, in Alberta, people will be expected to understand why they think sometimes they don't produce oil, but instead produce statistics, whether it's about labor, about the figures of production, about housing markets, or about environmental costs. You get all sorts of data and statistics. Very quickly, you can start to see, well, this is a very big issue. You can throw things around like how many tons of greenhouse gases are going to the oil a day, are going into the air a day to produce this oil. I call it mock oil. It's synthetic crude. It's not real oil at this point. But you can get these numbers, and they'll just quickly start to wrap into your head as a bunch of data, like taking a math class. Getting that kind of impact that was in my head this last summer, myself and the editor of the Dominion paper, which you can pick up outside, Drew Ojijay, as well as Maya Robingani, who works with the misguided.org website, decided to go travel up to Fort McMurray and see the areas for ourselves. Once you get to Fort McMurray, first thing you see, at least for us, was that the town itself is falling apart. There's a population of around 50,000 people who live there, officially, but there's around 70,000 people at any given time. You'll have people living in the woods in tents. You'll have people living 12 into a house where there's supposed to be two or three. You'll have massive amounts of street crime, crack epidemics out of control. All of this is because this boomtown doesn't have any right to control its own destiny, because getting this oil to send it to the United States to help continue to fuel their climate change economy is the only thing that matters to the people who are running this country right now. So what did we do when we left Fort McMurray? We headed a bit north. When you stand on some of those plains, like right near the Syncrude plant, and have a look around, it's an absolute wasteland. There's something that, you know, I grew up here. I started out with as a young, guilty liberal. Looking at the climate change stuff wasn't even on the agenda yet. It was a time to fight against clear cuts. We'd heard about Clackwood Sound, lots of things around that kind of issue. Stuff that I still agree is very, very important, stuff that's still near to my heart. But I have a different feeling when I see a clear cut now. I see something that still has traces of life on the ground. Like you can get a little grass within a few months, sometime in a few years, maybe a couple of bushes here or there. Tar sands operations, particularly by the pilot plants of Syncrude and Suncor, you'll have like a sandy grass or wasteland of just pure gray. And it's as far as you can see in any direction. You can stand up and elevate yourself. You see nothing. Where there was once a muskeg and a full forest, sometimes even a river used to be there. Now it's just poisonous sand, useless forever. Unlikely to ever be able to grow anything again. Thus far, areas that have been cleared, not one has been certified as reclaimed by the Alberta government. This area's process is what you have to get to understand how it looks like that. So here come some of the statistics. First, what you have to do is you drain the area, where they call it breaking the ground. You get rid of all the water in the muskeg, and you flatten every single tree. This is actually already the second fastest rate of deforestation on the planet after the Amazon basin. That's the first stage. Then they get rid of those logs any way they can. Some workers will tell you that what they'll do is they'll pile those trees into the newly opened pits and cover the excavation material onto the old ones. That's the only way they can get rid of these trees fast enough. There's no process. Why? Because they're going at this incredible pace. When you finish doing that, then they have to dig, sometimes up to 70 meters deep. When they dig this stuff out, which they call overburden, we call it, you know, forest, trees, life, water. They call it overburden because it's just a burden. Get it out of the way. They'll dig all that stuff out, and then on an approximate average of 4 tons for 1 barrel of oil, they will take all of that land and just basically waste it. They put it into a giant vat called a slurry, spin it around with water, which will, again, be 4 times the amount of oil you'll get out of it, which is taken out of the Athabasca River primarily. And when that's all done, then you still only have a lumpy substance called bitumen. The bitumen then will be shipped to something called an upgrader, where they'll do something similar to another process. At that point, maybe you'll get to a synthetic crude, which is still gross and dirty. This whole process has released incredible amounts of toxic gases just to produce it. Then we get to the point where it's somewhere down the line, almost always in the United States, it'll get burned in somebody's car, or quite often for the U.S. military. That's what you get for the 30% that's commonly called the Fort McMurray Alberta tar sands. Those areas in the Athabasca region are actually only 20 to 30% of the recoverable oil that's in the area. The other 70% is too deep into the ground to mine in this fashion. That's where they come up with the in situ, or SAGD, which stands for steam-assisted gravity drainage. That's where you take in an area where normally for a sweet crude that flows almost somewhat easily in a pipe, you would have to have only one spigot. You'll have to have 6 to 12 in these areas. When you have those ones plunk into the ground, they use up even more energy. You'll produce only about one barrel of oil. You'll have to use at least a third of a barrel of oil or equivalent energy to produce in the mineable areas. It's a little bit higher, and meaning less energy efficient to do the in situ stuff. By comparison, if you pull a barrel of oil out of Iraq, you only have to use one barrel to get 100 barrels back. If you use one barrel here, you'll get 3 or less. And there are plans in the works for a particular region north of the Peace River area, which would have an even worse return on investment, energy investment. So just to put that in one last statistic quickly, the final estimate, if they get to their goal, we're right now at about 1.2 million barrels a day of this stuff that's being produced 24 hours around the clock, 365. That is currently producing about 24 million tons of greenhouse gases a year. They're going to be between 83, and that's if the industry's best estimates as to technology they don't have yet to reduce climate change emissions can actually come to fruition, or at the current technological rate, 175 million tons a year. If that means nothing to you because it's just a number, the only way you can come up with something in all of North America that does worse effects for climate change is if you add up all of the coal-fired plants that currently exist and are being planned for production in the near future. Then we'll have something in the equivalent of 500 million tons a year that'll come out of coal. We don't have that currently. What we currently do have is an out-of-control tar sand development. A couple of the other things that are not directly attuned to climate change. Climate change is reducing the levels of these rivers. I touched on the idea that you need 4 barrels of water, which will be sucked out of the Athabasca River, which has already dropped 10 feet annually, to produce this particular form of synthetic crude. When you use that water up, it doesn't go anywhere. It can't be returned to the system. It's toxic. It will give you all sorts of crazy cancers, and in fact, already doing that downstream in many communities. What you have to do is find somewhere to store all that water. Well, you have visible areas right now in massive tailings ponds, which you can see from outer space. By the time they're done, the amount of these particular lakes of useless crap will be the size of Lake Ontario. Currently in the world today, the largest dam will be the Three Gorges Dam. The largest dam by volume on the planet is the Syncrude Dam, holding in one tailings pond just outside of the Syncrude's first pilot plant, which started 40 years ago. I mentioned before that there was a cancer rate that's going crazy in communities downstream. In Fort Chipewyan, Alberta, which is the oldest white settlement in Alberta, but it's today primarily Dene and Cree, it had a cancer rate for something that would normally happen in 1 in 100,000 people. There are 5 cases of it in this particular community. The only real question is whether or not it's coming from the fish and game or whether it's coming from the water systems, which are still using Lake Athabasca itself to deliver this water to people. The Alberta government was asked over 10 years ago to look into these health problems and deal with it. Of course, not being a big white center like Edmonton or Grand Prairie, they've been ignored over and over. So Fort Chippewyan managed to come up with a way to finance their own investigation into this in the last year, which became out the Chimney Report just about 2 months ago, where they were able to establish, yes, in fact, it was primarily the fish and moose of the area who continue to live off of what are now toxic waters. They're definitely causing leukemia, lupus, cholangiocarcinomas, and more to skyrocket through the community. They're burying people every month. But what the Alberta government is saying is, well, there's really high cancer rates on all these places, many different reserves and isolated communities, so we're not going to say this is a particularly bad case. They are kind of right. These conditions are rather prevalent, but they're actually just basically trying to sweep it under the rug, obviously. So the infrastructure that you need to build a project, which my friend Peter Sivek coined the Giga Project, is absolutely astronomical. You could take about 40 of the different projects there, and each one of those would be a mega project unto itself, something akin to building a massive highway from here to Whistler or something to that effect. You might be familiar with that idea. With that many that we have, the Giga Project needs to have all sorts of delivery systems. As I say, you need one-third the amount of energy to come in to produce what goes out. So what you need to do with that is get what remains of the natural gas in North America. The combined total of the Alaska's major deposits on their north slope and the total of the stuff in the Beaufort region of the Mackenzie Delta will be enough to produce up to 5 million barrels of synthetic tar sand crude a day. However, that tends to cross all sorts of other ecological regions and regions that are unceded to many nations in the area. I touched on what happens to the dead show there with the Mackenzie pipeline. Many of you might have heard of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in the Alaska area. Right next to that, what they call the National Petroleum Reserve, has an equally important caribou herd, which has thousands of caribou that go through a year, like the water buffalo still do in Africa, one of the only remaining herds like that on the planet. But it's not making big funds for large environmental groups to send out little flyers to you once a month asking for more money. So it's kind of been written off, but that particular pipeline system would deliver about 4 billion cubic feet a day directly into the tar sands or into other parts of the Alberta system. Then, once you've produced this stuff, you've got to send it somewhere. One of the main places they want to send it is out to the west coast near Kitimat, where the Douglas Channel meets the ocean. In that particular area, you're crossing, with the exception of the Nisga, nothing but unceded territory. In that particular region, you also have a lawsuit that's been launched by the carrier Secony. It would be to deliver not just oil to China, Japan, and Korea, but also to California, where they're building massive upgraders for tar sands bitumen, despite the clean air policy we keep hearing about that Schwarzenegger supposedly undertaken. But that really doesn't have anything what to do with what they're going to do with the tar sands bitumen. They've been very clear on the fact when Stelmach was recently visiting Washington that, no, don't worry, these new regulations won't actually cover that. So when they actually start delivering all that stuff down there, we're going to lose the offshore oil and gas moratorium that we have in B.C. The reason that was established in the 70s is people didn't like the idea of a lot of poisons ending up in the ocean. It also happens to be the major migration route for humpback and gray whales, as well as sea lions and others, would cross over 1,000 salmon spawning areas and ultimately deliver yet more stuff to primarily the United States. Then you can go east, you go through Manitoba, where the Rideau River First Nation, with its probably well-known chief, Terry Nelson, have recently launched a challenge there, as well as the Alberta Federation of Labor, warning of losses of jobs and deregulation, have been trying to prevent this establishment of a pipeline which should be delivering about 1 million barrels a day to the U.S. These are all just tiny little bits of the puzzle. If I were to sit here and list off every single one of these major pipelines, they would take me more than the rest of my talk. These are just the ones that people are actively already struggling against. So what does Canada plan to do about all this? Well, destroy everything that we've got as a social safety net to make sure we facilitate it. The SPP, people know, is another one of those private backroom deals that is designed to help make corporations run everything and reduce our ability to affect local change. But that goes not far enough into understanding what's going on with the tar sands, because the tar sands, in my opinion, are the primary driver. The SPP even has an entire working group called the Oil Sands Expert Group. They set it up in Houston in February 2006, where they called for the immediate cessation of any further and the reduction of existing environmental regulations with Canada, the ability to start shipping water out, but even more importantly, the establishment of a massive new temporary foreign worker program. Temporary foreign workers, why is that important to the tar sands? Because there is no labor left in Alberta. These production targets are so extreme and so obscene that the only way you can possibly achieve it up to this time, where they're at 1.2 million barrels a day, has been to fly people in currently from the Maritimes weekly. You can work in Nova Scotia, fly for 5 days to the tar sands, and the company will fly you back home to spend 2 days with the kids, and they'll fly you back again next week. This is a pretty good deal if you can get it, but eventually they've come up with a better plan. Since they're running out of that, and now Danny Williams has the offshore deal that he's got for Newfoundland, which is going to start seeing a trickle out of Fort McMurray, which is already about half Maritimer, we're going to start seeing what will happen instead. They're going to have to import tens of thousands of foreign workers, which they're going to call their temporary foreign worker program, or guest workers, into the Lowell region. The ones that are currently working in actual tar sands only number in the hundreds. Last year, the CNRL plant, Canadian Natural Resources Limited, had 500 different temporary foreign workers working in one little pilot project. They're not allowed to leave the work site. The unions are not allowed to visit them. They're kept behind fences. The whole point of what they're doing there is to make sure they get used as quickly as possible and get sent back. There is no procedure for them to apply for permanent status, and when they're finished being worked on, the only person who can keep them there is the employer. So what do they have to go to make sure that their rates are paid, which we don't know? We actually don't have access to what they're even being paid. Well, we don't have that. And the SPP is being designed to facilitate that growth. So what's the point of all this? Peak oil is the major issue of the day that is contradicting any attempt to go after climate change. This major issue right now has already got us to the point where outside of the Orinoco Basin in Venezuela, there is no other major oil source on the planet that can have a massive increase in production and capacity. So therefore, the building of this is a way that the U.S. has decided to hedge their bets, and Canada as well, for that matter. The way I say hedging their bets, 2003, the war in Iraq, everyone said it's about oil, quite correct. There's a big chunk of it going for that. But the fact was is that they couldn't get the Iraqi people to just go, yes, please, take everything. So when that resistance started, then it was a complete reversal of policy. At the end of 2003, Dick Cheney went to the National Energy Board and decided they were going to dive headlong into the tar sands. And ever since then, you'll see headlines in the business sections over and over again. Threat on Iran while Suncor stock prices rise. Think of this sort. They need to have $35 to $40 barrels of oil on the market globally to be able to make even a little bit of a profit in the tar sands. The higher the price of the tar sand of regular oil goes, the higher the market share control that imperialists have becomes. So therefore, every single time you see the price go up, realize that means more people are getting poisoned, more land is being stolen, and more is happening to raise climate change into the stratosphere in northern Alberta. And everywhere else for that matter. So primarily, the only other stuff to really talk on is that the absolute devastation has hit Edmonton in a real way. When the Canadian dollar recently surpassed the US dollar, a few economists pointed out that this is because of this massive boom going on in northern Alberta. It's not really about trying to maintain the US housing market. Oil does continue to grease the system that we live in. So if we want to deal with the price of oil, we got to deal with the system itself. The housing crisis in Edmonton is absolutely off the graph. There is a massive amount of survival sex work going out of control as rent has gone off the graph as well. We've got people who are, you know, having to perform all sorts of untoward acts just to have one night to be able to sleep throughout the city of Fort McMurray, some of them as young as 15. This is what we're dealing with and what Alberta has been sacrificed for. A major point I like to make is that the Socreds and the Conservatives in Alberta have never seen even a Liberal, let alone a new Democratic government for 60-some-odd years. And there's a reason for that. If you're working for the oil industry and you're able to get basically what you want, you've got, you know, whether, you know, sorry to be a little cruel, but rednecky politics, then maybe this is your government you want. So in, you know, Liberal Democratic terms, the Albertan people have got the democracy they've always wanted. That's gone. This is the lowest common denominator you can find across the entire province. You talk to people there, they no longer feel that they have any control. And they're quite right. As Fort McMurray spirals into oblivion, their own mayor, one of the most pro-industry people you'd ever want, Melissa Blake, recently called on the Edmonton government to call on the Ottawa government to impose a moratorium on the development of any further plans. Just to get an idea of what a moratorium means, the approvals for the 7 major plants that already exist, plus the Kearl project, which hasn't started yet, these are the ones that they've already given permission to, total an area of size over Vancouver Island. If you want to get what's going to be coming out of this at the end, we're going to be decimating an area the size of Florida or slightly larger than the state of New York. Gone. Why is that worth doing? Well, why isn't Fort McMurray worth listening to? Because this isn't about Edmonton, it's not about Ottawa, it's not even about Washington. It's about Houston and it's about Cushing, Oklahoma. These are the people that have been working hand in glove with Halliburton for a long time and are taking our future with it. Let's keep in mind, you can't green capitalism. You can only destroy it. Thank you.
You have been listening to McDonald Stainsby on the Canadian Tar Sands, recorded January 20th, 2008, by Radio EcoShock. You can download this free speech from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Look on our Peak Oil or Climate Change pages of the Audio On Demand menu. The speech was part of a presentation called Can We Stop Global Climate Change? Put on by the Vancouver Socialists. McDonald Stainsby's articles are published in alternative journals like Counterpunch, ZNet, Briar Patch, and Dominion Magazine. But in particular, you should search out the special Tar Sands edition of Dominion Magazine for November 2007. It is a 47-page guide with maps, photos, awful photos, and insider stories from people literally working in the camps. It is a portrait of life under total corporate control, in some ways like a well-paid Stalinist dream. You can find this issue of Dominion Magazine online at dominionpaper.ca/tarsands. That's dominionpaper.ca/tarsands. And don't forget Stainsby's Tar Sands site at oilsandstruth.org. The tar sands aren't about Alberta or even Canada. There is a developing network of pipelines and refineries and trade agreements connecting this giant spider web of oil from the very high Arctic of Alaska and Canada to the American Midwest and all the way down to Texas and the Canadian Pacific Coast. If the Middle East blows up, worse than it already has, if Venezuela or Russia shut off the energy tap, America and American oil companies plan to wring out the Canadian landscape for every last drop of oil. Canada is the security blanket for American motorists and power companies, and the entire production of the tar sands currently could easily be replaced by simple conservation, by saving energy. No Canadian political party other than the Greens has called for an end of tar sands development. The current government is totally oil-friendly, trying to remove impediments, you know, like environmental laws or native people. Royalties are lower than anywhere else on Earth, and the usual big corporate tax subsidies for oil are in place. One company got $320 million in a tax grab just this year. Government will never stop the tar sands as long as political parties accept corporate donations. As the leader of the Liberals, the alleged climate man Stéphane Dion said, "No one can stop the tar sands. There's just too much money in it." Only the workers and the people of Canada can fight off this vampire destroying the land, the water, and the atmosphere. And Americans need to join in too, please. Don't do this to get oil. Get active. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. Download our weekly program and tons of free green audio from our website at ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. And by the way, I'm sorry to report such bad news that humanity has become so insane in things like the tar sands and climate change. All the animals and plants are becoming sorry too. And now it looks like Gaia, the interactive living ecosystem of the Earth, may be getting ready to give a lot of us the boot. So tragic for a species that has such great potential. Well, let's try some more and meet again next week on Radio EcoShock.